Welcome to the Monday edition of Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And actually, no, this is the weekend edition of Mideast Migraines, which comes to you every Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcasting at, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial, and we are streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. Click on the red oval that you see on our main page or on the listen link to find out how to listen to our live stream. My name is Ren Tawil. Let me give you the phone number right off now to the studio so that you may call me at some point in the next couple of hours. And area code 831, that's Santa Cruz County, California, area 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. I am your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian American. Born and bred here on the left coast of North America, my father is a native of Jerusalem. Banished, effectively banished from his home when in May of 1948 he happened to be here on the West Coast with the complete intention of returning to his home and his family in the old country, but Israel canceled his British-issued passport and he never went back again. The rest of the family pretty much eventually moved, well, many members of his family and extended family who had survived what was going on over there in 1948, made it to the New World. Some of them ended up in refugee camps. I think that says enough about where I'm coming from. I do not make an extended effort to be impartial or supposedly balanced in my approach to the subject. There's already plenty of pro-Israel and pro-Zionist propaganda that American society has been inundated with for the almost going on 70 years of Israel's existence, and the victims, the true victims in this conflict, the Palestinian Arabs, not to mention the other neighboring Arabs, have taken the brunt of blame for being victims. Okay, Saturday issues of the Mideast Migraines program are dedicated to the readings of recent or reasonably recent books, entire books, on the topic of Palestine and Israel. I have read the following to the best of my memory, the following books over the past almost 3 years now. In November of 2013, it was Max Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. The entire book over the course of 3 or 4 months. Very interesting. And then I went from there to former Illinois Congressman Paul Finley's They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby. And the readings, the recordings that have survived, my attempt to record them, which is almost all of the chapters, are available at the following website, radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.NET, radioforall.net, plug in Mideast Migraines into the search box, and you will pick up on these past readings of very excellent pieces of literature, whole books, and you can read the chapters and installments at your pleasure when and where you want to. Let's see, after Paul Finley's book, eventually came Freedom Sailors, which is a personal favorite of mine, not least of all because there are a couple of paragraphs in Freedom Sailors that were written by me. It's an edited compilation of the experiences and the scribblings of some 43 activists who sailed from the port of Larnaca, Cyprus, into the port of Gaza City in the Gaza Strip in 2008. 8 years ago now. And after that, I'm a little fuzzy on the exact chronology. I read an edited small paperback book. I don't want to say booklet because it's a book in its own right. It was entitled Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives. It was edited and compiled by Jewish Voice for Peace. 8 articles, all written by Jews. Each one a different one. And again, the readings of these are available at radioforall.net. And fascinating take on the whole topic of what anti-Semitism truly is and what a true anti-Semite is and isn't. And then eventually I got around to reading Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, An American Jewish Woman in the Occupied Territories. As a book per se, Witness in Palestine was my favorite because it was utterly chock full of not only the fascinating experiences of Ms. Balzer, Anna Balzer, in the territories as a Jewish person, working and living among Muslims and Christians under occupation. Lots and lots of scholarly material, maps, of course, full-color pictures, and even drawings by traumatized children living under those circumstances. Many very painful, almost unbelievable experiences that Balzer had. Check that one out, Witness in Palestine. And, you know, I may end up leaving a book out. I don't have them written down in front of me in the proper order of chronological reading, but eventually I got around to reading Miko Peled's The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko is another Jewish man who was born and raised in Jerusalem, as was my Christian father. He lives in Coronado, California, down there, way down close to the international border with his family. Miko Peled also had some jaw-dropping, hair-raising, and frankly, occasionally disgusting renditions of life for the Palestinians down there, and very, you know, of the many books that I've read on the topic, Miko's is one of the, again, like Balzer's book, very painful and very personal effort, and he talks about what, quite frankly, is quite apparent, that this whole experience of facing up to the realities of life in Palestine very painful for him, and he had to be forthright in his depiction of what was going on. His father, by the way, Miko Peled's father, was Israeli Army General Mati Peled, the late Mati Peled, who himself, although a veteran of the war which founded Israel in 48 and a general in the war of 1967 there, which swallowed up the remainder of historic Palestine after that war, based on his experiences and the things that caused him to question the whole Zionist project, averted him from war and concretely choosing peace, choosing to go in a direction of reconciliation with the Palestinians, who have by far been the losers in the whole history of things here. So we have Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, Congressman Paul Finley's They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby, Freedom Sailors, which was edited by Greta Berlin and Dr. Bill Dienst, both of whom were founders of the Free Gaza Movement, which sponsored the sailings into Gaza. The JVP's Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives, Anna Baltzer's Witness in Palestine, An American Woman, An American Jewish Woman Visits the Occupied Territories, full subtitle. Miko Peled's The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And I know I'm leaving at least one out. The main thing is, though, we are currently on reading another entire book, Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, whose author is also a Jew, an American Jew, who resides in Maryland. His name is Mark Braverman. Okay. Now, I want to get right to it here. Let me point out another couple of technical assists here in getting this program off the ground. If you want to communicate with me and are not into calling the station straight up, per se, while I'm here doing this live show for Saturday, September 10, 2016, weekend edition, Mideast Migraines, then you can write to this program's email address, which is MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's G as in generalization, M as in mercurial, X as in xylophone, MideastMadness@gmx.com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. And I see that I have some online listeners right now, which is very exciting. We do broadcast to the city of Santa Cruz in California, which brings me, oh my goodness, quite a few listeners, to an important announcement. In the maintenance of our radio service, which has been around for over 21 years, Free Radio Santa Cruz, liberating our airwaves since 1995, we need a new transmitter site as soon as possible. East side of Santa Cruz is preferred for best reception for the greatest number of people. West side is doable, but not in downtown. This, of course, is we're on the FM band, and FM signals require what's called line of sight transmittability. over tall buildings and single bounds and over the treetops so that everyone can get a clear signal. So that's why downtown won't work. Too many buildings, too many too many acoustical holes, as it were. The site for our transmitter requires access to electricity and internet, and a space of only about 4 feet by 4 feet for our shack, which is roughly fat refrigerator-sized, mostly vertical wooden box for keeping the equipment related to transmission in at the foot of the transmitter. So the whole actual real estate space needed for the transmitter is maybe we'll say 6 by 6 feet, and that's it. But we do need electricity and internet access there, a tall tree, a roof, or a hill for the antenna. As I said, must be able to, quote, see Santa Cruz and the east side, referring to the tip top of the transmitter. Clear view, clear range for transmission. Please send an email to frsc@freakradio.org if you can help us find a new location or direct us to such a location. Contact us at frsc@freakradio.org. There is also a contact link at freakradio.org for you to refer to in contacting us with your help, folks. This is indeed, or at least tries very hard to be, an interactive community radio activity here. Non-compliant with the Federal Communications Commission. We are an unlicensed pirate station and proud of it. We do that as an ongoing expression of civil disobedience so that we are not ensnared by government or corporate restrictions on our editorial content or musical content. Okay, I think we're ready to go now. With Fatal Embrace, I gotta grab my... Arg! Where are my glasses?
What did you do with my glasses?
Still can't find my glass case. Just gotta find out where I was. We are actually still in the midst of Chapter 6, I believe. As soon as I... Ooh, it's a long chapter. Part 2, Chapter 6. Very quick description of where we've been in the reading of Fatal Embrace here. About this book, part one, which is behind us now, set out the basics of what the author believes to be the barriers to achieving peace in the Holy Land. All of part one, which is comprised of four chapters. Chapter one provided an interview of the discourse in the United States over how to resolve the half-century-long conflict. It's more like two-thirds of a century at this point, almost. And it raises the issues it raises for the Christian and Jewish communities. In chapter two, Mark Braverman tells the story of growing up Jewish in post-war America, and the crisis of identity and spirit that resulted from his encounter with Israel's occupation of Palestine. Remember, folks, these chapters are, most of them anyway, are recorded for posterity and appear at radioforall.net. Chapter 3 focused on the impact of anti-Semitism on Jewish history and Jewish experience today, while Chapter 4 is a discussion of Zionism. Its origins, consequences, critics, and defenders. This last chapter of part one covered the efforts of several Jewish writers to understand the historical, psychological, and spiritual forces driving the actions of the State of Israel and world Jewry's support of those policies that many regard as barriers to peace. Now, we're in part two, where he undertakes a consideration of Christianity's post-World War project to atone for anti-Semitism. Chapters 5 and 6 are a review of the effort by Christians to reverse the theology responsible for two millennia of Western anti-Semitism. And we're in chapter 6 now. He says here, we'll pay particular attention to the implications of this project for Christian attitudes toward modern political Zionism. Okay. You comfy? You have your pot of coffee all brewed up for you, or in your swathed in your Barca lounge there? I think some of you can hear what kind of radio influences I've had with those descriptions. Okay. Okay. Once again, I've gone to my bookmark place, but I'm going to... holy crap. Oh, well, we're pretty much at the beginning of chapter 6, so I may as well just, I'm only a page after the beginning, so we'll start chapter 6 again. Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land by Mark Braverman. Here a wee ago. Chapter 6, Theological Urgency and the Promise of the Land. Here's a quotation by James Carroll, author of Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews, that it took the Holocaust to open an honorable and reciprocal dialogue between Jews and Christians is an outrage. That it took the Holocaust to do that. But that the Holocaust requires us, personally as well as institutionally, to understand how such events were prepared for by other events is an absolute moral legacy. The question posed itself not to me but to history, namely, how did the cross of Jesus Christ become the cross of Auschwitz? Mark Braverman, the author, speaking here. I paid a visit to a professor of theology at the seminary of a major Protestant denomination. He is the author of articles and books in the post-supersessionist tradition, in which he takes on the blatantly anti-Semitic aspects of Christian doctrine, as well as strongly reaffirming the special relationship between God and the Jewish people. I told him that I felt we had a lot in common. That, as a Jew, I was committed, as was he as a Christian, to religious reform, to rooting out those elements in my religious tradition that require correction. Drawing on my reservoir of chutzpah, the Yiddish word chutzpah, I turned then to my critique of his work. Without question, I said, confronting the anti-Semitism embedded in supersessionism was a good thing. But had early Christianity's bold challenge to some of Judaism's central tenets really been such a misguided project? I told him that I thought that the very elements of Judaism there are typos in this book. I have to figure out what he's trying to say here. Yeah, okay, not here though. I told him that I thought that the very elements of Judaism in most urgent need of reform were precisely those that the early church had addressed, the early Christian church. I made it clear that my ideas arose out of my great distress about the negative outcomes of political Zionism and my sense that something deeply embedded in Judaism itself was at work in the abusive practices of the Jewish state. My concern was that in the rush to atone for anti-Semitism, progressive Christian theology was indirectly and often quite directly permitting and even validating these practices by establishing God's covenant with the Jewish people as fundamental and primary. I expressed to him my concern about the political implications of this stream in progressive Christian thought, and my concerns that it legitimated Israel's land grabs, suppressed criticism of Israel's human rights violations, and thwarted honest, productive interfaith dialogue about the Israel-Palestine situation. It's not easy getting comfortable here, but that's my problem. Continuing, the professor's response was swift. "That's an old story," he said to me. "It's the story of an archaic tribal Judaism and an enlightened universalist Christianity. We don't tell that story anymore." Close quote. He stated that even if this old story had not been discredited by virtue of its blatant anti-Semitism and its responsibility for millennia of persecution of the Jews, it was passé, having been demonstrated to be theologically unsound. I'm going to just turn to my refreshing cold drink here. Gulp. You too can enjoy a refreshing beverage, cold or hot, while you're listening. Continuing, theologically unsound. I was stunned by this reaction. Yes, this may be an old story, as it were. Much of late 20th century Christian theology is devoted to correcting this theory as, in the words of James D. G. Dunn, quote, "a parody of both Second Temple Judaism and Paul's debt to his Jewish heritage," 2003. This simplistic and biased black and white picture fully deserved to be discredited, especially in view of its pernicious efforts throughout Christian history. But I had expected more receptivity. The professor seemed close to a discussion about the issue. Anything, apparently, that bore even the whiff of Christian anti-Jewishness had to be summarily discounted and barred from further discussion. What was required, rather, was vigilance about the appearance of such views. Although the professor had written extensively on this precise topic, there would be no nuanced theological discussion today, because the important issue is not the theological soundness of the original discredited doctrine. What was important was the effect the doctrine had produced throughout history. Atoning for anti-Semitism trumped all other discussions. The exchange with the professor that day is far from an isolated case. Vigilance against anti-Semitism underlies or explicitly characterizes most interfaith discussions today. In our current political climate, it seems acceptable for Christians to look critically at those elements of their own faith and their history that have caused harm, especially when these have been cornerstones of their doctrine. But it is permissible to extend this conversation. But it is not permissible to extend this conversation into any criticism of Judaism or into the examination of the behavior of Jews or their institutions that might deserve scrutiny or correction. While Christian sins are fair game, criticism of Judaism or things Jewish is simply out of bounds. I'm grabbing my lovely old American flag, which adorned our old studio for a while. It's all folded up now. I'm going to rest the book on it here. Don't want to wreck the spine. Okay, now, new post section, the Christian sin. Again, I am reading from Mark Braverman's Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. Once again, beginning chapter 6, the Christian sin. In the wave of horror and revulsion that overtook Christians in the wake of the Nazi Holocaust, combating anti-Judaism became a primary concern. Anti-Jewishness, writes contemporary Protestant theologian Robert T. Osborne, is the Christian sin. Anti-Jewishness is the Christian Sin, from his writing in 1990. Note that Osborne does not say that anti-Judaism is a sin. It does not say that anti-Judaism is a sin. Rather, anti-Jewishness has taken first place as the Christian transgression. Correcting it would require a fundamental overhaul of the faith. According to theologian Paul Van Buren, forging a positive relationship with Judaism and the Jewish people is nothing less than the reimagining of what it means to be Christian. Writes Van Buren, if the church stops thinking of the Jews as the rejected remnant of the people of Israel, if it starts speaking of the continuing covenantal relationship between this people and God, then it will have to rethink its own identity, 1984. In a real sense, revisionism turned this aspect of Christian theology on its head, which is to say, Judaism would no longer be seen as Christianity's shadow, but rather would take its rightful place as the very foundation of Christian faith. A generation of pastors was raised on this new perspective as part of their seminary training. No longer would anti-Jewish sentiments be heard from the pulpits. Offending passages from the Gospels would increasingly be passed over or explained away. The professor's reaction was not based simply on a disagreement on a matter of theology or the history of religion. He was saying that you simply cannot say these things about Judaism. But was he really listening? Apparently, what he had understood, apparently what he had understood me to say was that Judaism is an archaic religion and that it deserved to be replaced by the new superior faith. That would be the old story. And then in quotes here, the story we don't tell anymore. But that is not what I was saying. Rather, I was calling attention to exclusivist and exceptionalist elements of Judaism that had persisted, incubating over thousands of years. I was suggesting that these are the elements of our faith and our perception of ourselves that have become so devastatingly problematic in the modern context, having now been activated through Jewish empowerment. I was not saying that Judaism as a whole is archaic, or that these elements characterize the entire faith tradition or every Jewish attitude. Certainly that would be a one take on the Pauline anti-Jewish polemic, but that was not what I was proposing. My interlocutor was responding as if my suggestion that Judaism possessed elements in need of reform was damning the entire faith and, by extension, the Jewish people itself. I wish I could have been as clear at that moment. I wish I could have been as clear at that moment. What I did say was, quote, when I tell Christians they are not being anti-Semitic when they raise questions about Zionism or about the actions of the State of Israel, they are very appreciative. They appear very receptive, even hungry, to hear this message! Exclamation point, close quote. Again, his response was sharp. Of course they like to hear it, he said. You are telling them that they are not anti-Semitic. How can you be so sure? Once again, we were not communicating. His assumption was that this discourse is about assuring Christians that they are not anti-Semitic. It is nothing of the sort. It is about allowing a dialogue. It is about disabusing Christians of the notion taught to them in the pews and in the seminaries that it is not okay to challenge political Zionism or to criticize the policies of the State of Israel. The accusation of anti-Semitism is the club brandished to thwart open or critical discussion about the state of Israel. I'm going to read that again because it's central. The accusation of anti-Semitism is the club brandished to thwart open or critical discussion about the state of Israel. The unstated assumption among Jews and Christians alike is that Judaism is indistinguishable from Zionism, and that, therefore, to be critical of Zionism is to be anti-Semitic. But the issue has to be named. It is the elephant in the room. Okay, new subsection. A guest in the House of Israel. The history of post-Holocaust revisionist theology is that of Christianity's attempt to reverse the effects of two millennia of anti-Semitism. To call this a project in systematic theology is a misnomer. It is more than a revision or, quote, fix of a doctrine seen as archaic, outmoded, embarrassing, or destructive. Rather, this project represents a fundamental reworking of how Christianity understands the relationship of God to humankind. Furthermore, it is not limited to rehabilitating Jews by exonerating them of the charge of deicide, meaning, I guess, to kill God. Anyway, nor is it confined to a positive, no-cost statement about religious tolerance and the need for acceptance of multiple faiths and ways to God. No, this reformulation places God's original covenant with the Jews at the center of Christian belief, incorporating into Christian theology fundamental principles of Judaism, such as election and promise. In Van Buren's words, quote, taking Judaism into Christian theology, really into it, 1984. In a striking but apt phrase, theologians in this tradition talk about the re-Judaization of Christianity. Furthermore, this is a theology that is very tied to practice. Practice that stems from the Christian world's traumatic confrontation with the consequences of anti-Semitism in the 20th century. Practice focused on vigilance against anti-Semitism. I'll break away for a moment here. You will occasionally hear me quoting a very small segment of another author's work. And then I give you the year of publication of that work. Indeed, Braverman does have, which he used in writing this book, and occasional footnotes. And he's very careful to let us know when he is quoting the works of another author, Mark Braverman. Okay, back to the book. Clark M. Williamson's 1993, A Guest in the House of Israel, Post-Holocaust Church Theology, is a scholarly, comprehensive treatment of the revisionist perspective. There has been, observes Williamson, a, quote, profound theological urgency, close quote, to revisit the New Testament in order to correct the anti-Judaism so interwoven in the gospel narratives and the epistolary writings. Williamson cautions against such urgency, noting that historical analyses motivated in this way often, quote, tell us more about their authors than their subject. Yet we will see how Williamson himself encounters this difficulty in his effort to bring Christians and Jews together to build a better world. In his opening chapter, Williamson presents three, quote, rules for what he terms a post-Shoah theology. I'm pretty sure that the word Shoah, spelled in English here S-H-O-A-H, is the Hebrew word referring to the 20th century Holocaust. Okay, in his opening chapter, Williamson presents three rules for what he terms a post-Shoah theology. First, conversation with Jews. Christians, writes Williamson, cannot give theological shape to their self-understanding as Christians without engaging in conversation with Jews. That's point one. Williamson advocates a reinterpretation of Jesus and of Paul with respect to their Jewishness and their relationship with the Judaism of their time. Point two, the burning children. Williamson asserts that any Christian theology must establish the Shoah, which is to say the Nazi Holocaust, as a fundamental point of reference. He cites theologian and Rabbi Irving Greenberg's principle, quote, "No statement, theological or otherwise, should be made that would not be credible in the presence of the burning children," from Greenberg's work, 1977. Any Christian theology, indeed any theology, writes Williamson, must meet the test of Auschwitz, quote unquote, 1993. Third point, third of author Williamson's points here, discipleship. So we have conversation with Jews, the burning children, and now discipleship. Theology must lead to a way of life that is focused on repairing the world through good works. Williamson relates this directly to the first rule, namely that Christians must now be guided in their relationship to humankind by the divine commandments to the Jewish people set down in the Jewish scriptures. Conversation with Jews, the burning children, and discipleship. Williamson's adoption of the term Shoah is noteworthy. The word from the Hebrew word meaning utter and sudden destruction came into common use in the 1950s to refer to the near total extermination of European Jewry by the Nazis. The use of this word implies that this disaster, this genocide, stands alone in the history of crimes against humanity. Shoah is another way of saying the Holocaust. It's interesting to consider that the Nazi Holocaust, alone in the long history of the persecution of the Jews in the West, has provoked this fundamental revision in Christian theology. Why is this so? Clearly, this is not the first historical instance that could have prompted Christian leaders to examine their theology with respect to the Jewish people. One possible explanation is that this is seen as no mere crime. The Shoah was not an isolated paroxysm of violence, but the culmination of millennia of persecution. Christian theologians after World War II realized that the Holocaust had emerged directly out of Christian animus against the Jews. Williamson offers the chilling and compelling observation that the Nazis' Nuremberg laws drew directly from canon law from medieval times that served to restrict Jews and marginalize them in society. That's fascinating. The confrontation with the Nazi Holocaust shook Christianity to its core, as well it should have. It necessitated a wholesale reevaluation of central articles of faith and of identity. Christians stood before the ovens and the bodies piled like cordwood and saw not only the present horror, but the millennia of demonization, expulsion, and massacres, and experienced shock, revulsion, and shame of catastrophic proportions. In parentheses, the author finishes this section by writing, "This is not us. they, sorry, this is not us, they must have felt. This is not what God intended. This is not what our faith in Jesus Christ leads us to. More beverage here. And I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. New section, theological urgency. The reexamination of the historical Jesus' relationship with Judaism is a central concern of post-Holocaust Christian theology. Williamson takes direct aim at, quote, a self-conscious Christian tradition that deliberately distanced itself from the historical Jewish context in which Jesus had lived and died, close quote. Traditionally, Jesus is portrayed as being in conflict with the Judaism of his time, with his death on the cross as the inevitable outcome, parenthetically, with the resulting deicide charge. Doctrinally, the resurrection was presented as proof of God's rejection of the Jews, doctrinally speaking. To combat this view and the theology it spawned, revisionism offered a new theology and a new picture of the historical Jesus, as well as a revised picture of Judaism itself. In this revision, Jesus is not portrayed as an iconoclast and social revolutionary in conflict with the Judaism of his time, a Judaism described in the traditional formulation as decadent and degenerate. This was a Judaism, in Williamson's words, quote, that never existed. Instead, Jesus is presented as having been primarily opposed to Rome and to the co-opting of the temple structure into the oppressive imperial colonial system. Rome, therefore, was the problem, not Judaism. What Jesus wanted in this view was a purification and restoration of the kingdom of God, now reinterpreted as a Jewish eschatology. In this revision, therefore, Jesus is a restorationist, or, depending on your perspective, a preservationist, of a landed Jewish polity based on Torah. A Jesus, in other words, promoting the Old Covenant. Now, here is a footnote. Progressive Christian interpreters such as Marcus Borg, John Shelby Spong, Dominic Crosson, Richard Horsley, and Neil Elliott share this view of Jesus' ministry as driven by an opposition to Roman oppression and its Jewish client class, rather than as directed primarily against Judaism or Jewish practice per se. I will explore in later chapters how this view of Jesus and early Christianity takes these thinkers in an entirely different direction than that of the restorationist view articulated by Williamson and the revisionist school. Yes, indeed, folks. In just about every reading, in every episode of Mideast Migraines, which are dedicated to the reading of the chapters of Fatal Embrace, I find myself tending to apologizing for the rather deep and perhaps extreme level of the author's Braverman's scholasticism, his scholarliness, and obviously we're not, in these early chapters in the book, we're saying nothing directly about the Palestinian Arabs, although we are talking about Christians, and of course many Palestinian, thousands and thousands of Palestinian Arabs are Christians, not necessarily Islamic Muslims. So you're not hearing a lot about the current debacle between Jew and Arab, between Israel and Palestine. Obviously, Braverman is setting us up for further discussion of the current situation. So, you know, and as I said, as I remember saying last week, don't try to absorb all of this, because it is, it's pretty heavy stuff. It's highly not only theological, but theoretical and philosophical. There will be no test. Listening to my program and the reading of this book does not require a background in theology. Just take from it, take from my readings of it what you can, and let it sort of percolate in your mind. And who knows, you might even be encouraged, inspired to buy the book yourself. Fatal Embrace. It's called Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. Printed by Beaufort Books, B-E-A-U-F-O-R-T, Beaufort Books. Visit fatalembrace.org for a study guide, updates, and more information. Now that's interesting, www.fatalembrace.org, study guide, updates, and more information. Okay, let's get back to the reading. I finished the footnote. Okay. And back to the text. Williamson's book is an important contribution to the history of religion and to the fascinating and important effort to understand the momentous events of the first century in Palestine. However, this is no passionate, neutral analysis. Rather, it is an argument driven by, to use Williamson's quoting of theologian John Gator's powerful phrase, the theological urgency to repudiate Christian anti-Judaism. 1983. That's a hefty sentence there. Let me read it again. Williamson's book is an important contribution to the history of religion and to the fascinating and important effort to understand the momentous events of the first century in Palestine. The first century in Palestine, 2,000 years ago. First century after Jesus' death. However, this is no dispassionate, neutral analysis. Rather, it is an argument driven by, to use Williamson's quoting of theologian John Gager's powerful phrase, the theological urgency to repudiate Christian anti-Judaism. But while the Judaism of Jesus' time may not have fit the later description of decadent and degenerate, this characterization of Judaism functions in this argument as a straw man. There he goes with the straw man again. Certainly, Judaism was disparaged in a grossly inaccurate and vicious way by Christianity throughout the ages. However, it is also likely that Jesus was confronting and speaking out against what he perceived to be real problems with the conservative and restoration-oriented nature of the Judaism of his time. The Pharisees were not the devil, but neither were they all good. This is an uncomfortable fact for Christian thinkers because of the virulent anti-Semitism that placed a central that occupied a central place in Christian doctrine. According to Williamson, the error of Christianity was that it defined itself in relation to Judaism. Quote, every Christian doctrine can be and was interpreted through the lens of this anti-Jewish hermeneutic. Especially difficult to pronounce words I've never seen when the word is entire word does not fit the end of the sentence and they have to hyphenate it. Every Christian doctrine can be and was interpreted through the lens of this anti-Jewish hermeneutic. God is the God who displaces the Jews and replaces them with Christians, close quote, 1993. And he's right. Christianity should define itself in its own terms and according to its own values, rather than an opposition to or as an improvement on or replacement for Judaism or any other faith tradition. But what we have here is no mere correction. What emerges from this drive to repudiate traditional Christian anti-Jewish thought is a stark reversal of the established doctrine. And then in italics, a reverse supersessionism, if you will. Ironically, Christianity is again seeking to define itself in relation to Judaism, but now, in place of accomplishing this in the negative by invalidating the original covenant between God and the Jewish people, it embraces that original covenant, retaining the Jews' special status as the parent faith. Rather than establishing a new covenant as a replacement for the first, the Christian enters into the original covenant, per the title of Williamson's book, as, quote, a guest in the house of Israel. Fundamentally, this formulation goes very far toward the elimination of official Christian anti-Jewishness. But it goes much further. It elevates Judaism to the level of an ideal. Christians are now saying, while once we saw ourselves as the light and you as the darkness, now you are the light that we need to illuminate our own nature, to fully understand God's plan for the church. Again, this is no mere exercise in systematic theology. In the current historical context, it has profound implications. Elevating Judaism to primary privileged status on a theological basis carries real meaning for the present day. Christians are, to borrow from the biblical story, ceding the patriarchal blessing and the primogeniture, and with the original covenant comes the land promise. The land promise. Much is made in Williamson's discussion about how much of Jesus' teachings of love springs from his Jewish tradition, the Pharisaic school that was the foundation of rabbinic Judaism. Yes, Christianity did arise from Judaism, and the monotheistic revolution that was Judaism started it all. Credit must be given. But that doesn't mean that Judaism is not in need of reform, of the, quote, conversation with other traditions that Williamson cites as one of the rules of a post-Shoah theology. The question must be asked, what is the recipient of the blessing doing with the power that it confers? And that's the end of that section. Let's take a break from the reading. You are listening to the Mideast Migraines Program Weekend Edition on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org and broadcasting on the FM dial at 101.3. lovely music from Tunisia. Now on track three, apparently these are all sewn together as one continuous experience here. But that's all I can tell you. This is a very obvious bootlegged album, traditional one, inferring that there are other albums in this series. Tunisia, traditional one. Not one bit further of further information. Bootleg City, folks. And it's international. It crosses intercountry boundaries. Ooh. Intrigue, spies, and Arabs. Okay, let's kill that for now, guys. And again, I can get these CDs for under $3. Even closer to $2 here in town in Santa Cruz, California. And you got what you pay for. But it appears to be music from Central North Africa, the country of Tunisia. Or perhaps performed and enjoyed by ethnic Tunisians, whether they're in neighboring Algeria or Morocco or wherever. Well, I better put my card game away here. Get back to the reading. It's 12:20 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. You are listening to the weekend edition of Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Please visit our website at freakradio.org. Check out our schedule, our contact links for your suggestions or hot creative ideas for a new transmitter site. Convey that information to us. Pass along your advice, your suggestion to FRSC at freakradio.org. FRSC, as in Free Radio Santa Cruz, at freakradio.org. Also, click the donations list there to donate to Free Radio. Right now, we happen to be very much in the black, but that is often not the case. And you never know what's going to happen to our current situation regarding our stay in this studio at this location, etc. Things are still kind of up in the air, sort of par for the course for old Free Radio. My name is Ren Tawil. There is another edition of Mideast Migraines on FRSC every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific. That's 1500 hours Pacific time. Mondays at 3 in the afternoon. That is a separately produced show where I will talk about more current, immediate and timely issues. Not only about Arabs and Jews, but about hopefully more local stuff. I'm paying more attention now to promoting local items and things. Let me see. I'm going to be running up to Half Moon Bay on Tuesday evening, because there's a organization called Fair Vote, which is trying its goldernest to institute important necessary changes in the American electoral system, Fair Vote. And they're having an event at Half Moon Bay on Tuesday the 13th, and the next day, I believe, in San Francisco. And I don't have the details in front of me, but that's just an example of some of the things that I like to talk about these days. I can say what I want to. I'm on Free Radio, so there. Yeah, let me check one more thing just so I can convince myself that people are listening to the program. Oh my God, we lost a listener. Well, that's only through that one channel. But that's still nice to know. Okay. Back to the book, folks. Well into chapter 6 now. About halfway through it. Recipient of power that it confers. New subsection. Reading. Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. This book was published in 2010, by the way, some 6 years ago. Written by Mark Braverman, who is an American Jew. The Christianization of Judaism. Election as Grace. What does all that mean? The renunciation of supersession is the keystone of the revisionist program. But building a theology that expunges supersessionism is not easy, since Christian doctrine is based on the notion that God's promise to the Jews had been fulfilled in Jesus Christ. That, in fact, the new covenant that conferred forgiveness from sin had, he italicizes here, superseded the original covenant. The new covenant that conferred forgiveness from sin had superseded the original covenant. Even if the revisionist project were to succeed in cleansing Christian theology and doctrine of the more explicit and blatant vilification of the Jews themselves, the problem remains. Christianity was a departure from Judaism in important ways. With respect to the relationship between God and humankind, it was a now different kind of deal, setting out different terms. The covenant with the Jewish people, which is the story of the Old Testament, specified that God would make the people great and prosperous and give them the land of Canaan in exchange for accepting him as their God and obeying his commandments. It was an exclusive arrangement between God and the Jews. The work of the followers of Jesus modified that arrangement in fundamental ways with respect to both theology and worldview. The announcement of Jesus' resurrection as the sign of the fulfillment of the divine promise to bring about the end of days was the basis of the work of the apostles from the earliest days after Jesus' death. It was directed first toward the Jews alone and then extended to the Gentiles. Logically, it meant that the old arrangement was gone. God's relationship to mankind was changed in several ways. The old arrangement involved belief, the acceptance of God as the one God, but also it involved behavior, adherence to a code of civil and religious law. In Christian idiom, the latter was called works, adherence to a code of civil and religious law. And early on in Christian doctrine, as articulated by Paul, this became counterposed to faith. The big change in Christianity was that salvation came by faith, not by works. This became a major point of argument and polemic for Paul, and later for Martin Luther, who cleared up any lingering ambiguity about the relationship between faith and works for achieving salvation. The new arrangement meant that no longer would salvation be dependent on what you do, but rather on your acceptance of Jesus Christ as Savior of humankind, as, in Paul's words, the, quote, free gift of God. This is crystallized in the concept of grace. In early Christian doctrine, further articulated by St. Augustine and later Protestant theologians, reliance on works was inferior, wrong, somehow thumbing our noses in the face of God's love of mankind and having sent Jesus to walk among us to wash away our sins and take away death. The Jews, by adhering to the old faith and rejecting the new one, became the despised of the earth until the end of days. And again, now, this is not the main example being that very last sentence. This is not the exclusive belief of the author, Mark Braverman. He is sort of speaking in second or third person here about the development of the Christianization of Judaism. Okay, let's continue. Herein lies the problem for the revisionist project. Supersession must be renounced, but everything is built on its assumptions. If you were to renounce supersessionism, you have to make the Jews okay with God again. You have to rehabilitate the original covenant. Over time, in the work of successive theologians, building on one another's work, a compelling and simple solution evolved. Take the cornerstone of the covenant with the Jews, which is God's election of the Jews as his people, italics here, and establish that this is an expression of God's grace. Folks, I'm trying hard to understand this as I'm reading it to you. Continuing, this is the key Christian construct called into service in order to reframe the Old Testament narrative. In this way, supersessionism is renounced. The Jews are no longer the ultimate foil, the darkness by which Christianity is the light. And at the same time, here is the power and the elegance of its formulation. A framework of redemption is created in which Judaism and Christianity can now exist. This is the view advanced by a number of writers representing the, quote, new perspective on Paul, a term coined by British New Testament scholar James D.G. Dunn in 1990. A major focus of the new perspective was to understand Paul's relationship with Judaism. This is a daunting task given the twists and turns of Paul's arguments and polemics. The thrust, however, is to argue for a closeness of Paul to the Judaism of his time. And I believe Paul lived within 100 or 200 years of the death of Jesus. Continuing. This is a significant departure from the traditional view of Paul as having denigrated Judaism as a rigid, archaic, legalistic religion, in contrast to Christianity's emphasis on God's freely given love. The new perspective focuses on Paul's efforts to create a strong link between the followers of Christ and all other Jews by virtue of their Jewish birth. In this view, what linked them was their lineage, regardless of any differences in belief. When Paul says in Galatians chapter 2, verse 15, "We ourselves are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners, yet we know that a person is justified not by works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ." This, according to Dunn, quote, is covenant language, the language of those conscious that they have been chosen as a people by God. Dunn, 1990. Here, Paul is asking Jews to understand that their faith in Jesus is not in contradiction to, but is, quote, an extension of their Jewish faith in a graciously electing and sustaining God. Emphasis added, he italicized graciously electing. The key here is in the phrase graciously electing. The two concepts are bolted together so that election becomes an act of, indeed a central function of God's grace. Quoting from Gerhard von Rad, R-A-D. Williamson further articulates this notion. Here's a long quote. In thinking anew about how to frame its understanding of covenant, the church must go up to Jerusalem to listen to the Jewish tradition. The covenant, here covenant making is a form of God's grace to which walking God's way, or from the Torah, halakha, is Israel's proper response. Its purpose is to teach Israel in order to order its life so that it may live justly and be a light to the Gentiles, to whom God and God's name are to be made known. God's covenant with Israel at Sinai is prefaced with these words, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Exodus chapter 20, verse 2. This preamble states in the indicative mode what God has done for Israel in a manner parallel to Paul's writing. The indicative of God's grace precedes the imperative. Quote, the God who speaks here, declared Gerhard von Rad, is the God of grace. By honoring the commands of God, Israel affirms God's gracious gift to and rule over Israel. 1993. End of extraction. In one stroke, God's promise to the Jewish people, beginning with the Abrahamic promise to the covenant at Sinai, prologue to the conquest of Canaan, has been connected in an unbroken line to Jesus' ministry and vision. But what has happened here? Grace is a Christian concept, perhaps the central defining concept of the faith. Can it be equated with the election of the Jewish people as recounted in the Jewish scriptures? It's uncanny. In an effort to rehabilitate Judaism, revisionist Christian theology has Christianized it. Supersession may have been overcome, but here Christianity has made Judaism over in its own image. The transformation in Williamson's argument is nearly complete, adding the most fundamental elements of each religious system into a stew of equivalency that comprises the meaning and integrity of both. Take, for example, Williamson's gloss on Torah, in Hebrew meaning instruction or guidance. As much as is made of the term in Jewish life, and as much as the term is used broadly, it is never confused with anything else. Torah is God's law. The manual for life is a Jew, covering both religious and civil life. But here's Williamson's take on the term. Quote, the broadest meaning of Torah is instruction in God's gracious will for a people who accept God's gift of grace. In the whole range of meanings that Torah has in the scriptures of Israel, it is comparable to what Christians mean by gospel. Close quote. Again, a neat solution, but it's simply inaccurate. It ignores and washes out essential fundamental elements of Judaism, elements that play a major part in our modern history as a people. Torah is not gospel. Election is not grace. The Old Testament covenant is not the New Testament giving of salvation. Oops. I'm just noticing some activity on the screen here. I'm trying to figure out what's going on. Get that out of the way there. Okay, sorry for the interruption. Someone's playing with my computer remotely. Torah is not gospel. Election is not grace. The Old Testament covenant is not the New Testament gifting of salvation. Promise in Judaism is not about forgiveness from sin. Rather, it is about blessing, in the way the ancient world understood the term. peoplehood, progeny, prosperity, and in the case of the Jewish people, land. The Hexateuch, the five books of Moses and the book of Joshua, hex obviously meaning six, is the Jewish people's story of itself, the story of its peoplehood, its relationship with God. It begins, as Williamson correctly points out, with God's introduction of himself to Abraham, his instruction to Abraham to settle in Canaan, and the promise to make his seed into a great people. This initial promise becomes increasingly articulated in the Old Testament narrative, continuing right through into the prophetic literature in the concept of election, namely, I have chosen you, the people of Israel, for a special role in history in exchange for your exclusive devotion to me and adherence to my laws. Yes, at times God talks about his love for Israel. This, as pointed out by a number of commentators, can be seen to balance the view of the God-Israel relationship as stern and legalistic. But election is not grace, the author emphasizes here. It appears, however, that for Christians in the aftermath of the Holocaust, the theological urgency to reconcile with the Jewish people was so great, the drive to find a theological meeting ground purged of the conflict and enmity of the past so compelling that this fundamental difference was wiped out. It is as if by validating Jewish election, and particularly by establishing it as a cornerstone of the Christian worldview, the horrors of the past could be undone. Williamson cites what is perhaps the ultimate statement of the covenant between God and Israel, Moses' extended address to the people of Israel, as presented in the book of Deuteronomy. Here, Moses reminds the people that, and I quote, "The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on earth to be his people, his treasured possession." Book of Deuteronomy, chapter 7. Verse 6. Citing this verse, Williamson comments, quote, "All the strata of tradition in the Pentateuch are cognizant that chosenness as such has to do with God's freely offered love and the appropriate response of Israel to that love, which is Israel's service to God and the peoples of the earth." Close quote. Note how God's election of Israel is framed here within a description that matches the Christian concept of grace. First, the word freely is a clear allusion to Romans 6:23, quote, "The free gift of God is eternal life." Second, note the addition of "and the peoples of the earth" to the description of God's divine obligation. This last phrase implies that explicit in God's covenant with the Jewish people is that this will be extended universally. But is this element part of the covenant of the Jewish people? Christians want to see it that way, but that doesn't make it so. This is not a concept found in the Pentateuch. Footnote: the case is made by some Christian and Jewish interpreters that evidence for the extension of God's charge to the Jews into a mission to humankind at large is to be found in post-Pentateuch biblical texts, specifically 2 Isaiah, Jonah, and Ruth. This argument will be taken up in later chapters. Yes, indeedy, this guy really gets into it. And the time is 12:43. The show normally goes up until around 1 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific time. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. I'm Ren Tuwil. This is the Mideast Migraines Program, reading from Mark Braverman's book, Fatal Embrace. Back to the main text. The revisionist effort to blur the differences between Christianity and Judaism is basically two-pronged. First, the particularism inherent in election morphs into the universality of grace. Second, the charge to Israel to serve God expands into a responsibility to serve all of humankind. Williamson, like many others, interprets the famous, quote, light to the nations phrase from 2nd Isaiah in this way. The Jews are God's chosen, so goes this argument, but their specialness comes with conditions. Jews must bring God's message of justice to the world. The Jews are particular, according to Williamson, but not exceptional, because, quote, chosenness did not entail an exclusive privilege. As I commented in the previous chapter, this explanation, familiar to me from my religious education, never made sense to me. I knew that, despite the disclaimer, I was being taught that as a Jew I was special, that as Jew I had been elevated above, quote, the nations. The, quote, conditionality of having a special responsibility in the world didn't mitigate the exceptionalism. In fact, it amplified it. We're on a mission from God! Exclamation point. The citing of God's often quoted promise to Abraham from Genesis 12, "In you all the families of the earth will be blessed," serves as another example of how this quality is superimposed on Judaism by Christian commentators seeking to emphasize the continuity between the traditions. This is accomplished not by interpretation or... got to get the accent right here. Interpolation. This is accomplished not by interpretation or interpolation, but by outright mistranslation. The passage is huge. Let me start this paragraph again. This seems to be central, and I want to read it without interruption. The citing of God's often quoted promise to Abraham from Genesis chapter 12, "In you all the families of the earth will be blessed," serves as another example of how this quality is superimposed on Judaism by Christian commentators seeking to emphasize the continuity between the traditions. This is accomplished not by interpretation or interpolation, but by outright mistranslation. This passage is usually translated as meaning that the Jews will bring blessing to the world, in other words, to refer to Israel's actions in or effects on the wider world. This is Williamson's, quote, service of the peoples of the earth, referenced above. But that's not what the verse means. The Hebrew is clear. It means that your name is invoked in blessings, as in, may you be like Israel. May you be blessed like the Jewish people. Rather than mitigating the exceptionalism, the passage underlies it. You are special, and all creation is to know and acknowledge this. Christians are free to reform, revise, and formulate their doctrine in conversation with history and in response to perceived problems. This is a good thing, an activity to be emulated by other faiths as we confront challenges to equally deeply held beliefs. But in their revisionist project, Christian thinkers have ventured into an outright reframing of fundamentals of Jewish theology and ethics. In Judaism, repentance is central, certainly, and yes, God is described as having qualities of mercy. But in Judaism, repentance bears but a very superficial resemblance to the Christian doctrine of grace. Indeed, this theory turns the Jewish concept of repentance on its head. In the Jewish scriptures and in rabbinic Judaism, repentance is tied to behavior. Abraham famously beseeched God to spare Sodom. Sodom, the place, the city. But he was not appealing to a categorical quality of forgiveness. Abraham's bargaining was not for the forgiveness of the sinners, but for the sake of any of the righteous people who might be found in the city. In his famous negotiation with God, Abraham brought the number down to 10. But those 10 had to be found, he emphasizes here, in order to reverse the divine decree. And we know how the story ends. In the quintessential story about repentance found in the book of Jonah, God spared Nineveh because they repented. Besides declaring a fast, the king of Nineveh demanded that, and I quote, "Everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that is in their hands." Book of Jonah, chapter 3, verse 8. That's Jewish repentance. You know, last night I was watching the television, going past midnight, and I was looking at a movie that I had seen before when it came out in, sometime in the 1970s, Oh God. You know, the one with John Denver and George Burns, the latter playing the Almighty himself. Oh God. I almost want to say tame by today's standards, but the very excellently written script still bears out. In the movie, George Burns is God, the God of Abraham, whoever, whatever, is constantly turning the interpretation of his teachings, whether through Judaism or Christianity, or both, on its head. A very, very simple case in point. The question is asked of God in the film, was Jesus your son? And God said, of course he was my son. And George Burns speaks in a kind of new, you know, his typical New York accent. God is speaking in an East Coast accent here. Of course Jesus was my son. So are you. So is the cab driver who brought me here today to your place to meet John Denver, whatever. So is the guy who stiffed me price of a hot dog down the street. They're all sons of God. You know, it's tame by today's standards in that sense. Arguments that have been made over and over. But it was, it still stands up on its own, I think, that film. Put together by people who would dare make modern 20th century interpretations of the word of the Almighty. A sequel was made of the film God Book 2, but I never saw that. Denver decided to bow out of that one, or they didn't want him, one of the two. So I suppose I should see the sequel. 40-year-old films there. 40-odd-year-old films. Just by the way, in case any of you were wondering, I was indeed, you know, I declared at the beginning, toward the beginning of the show, that my father was a Christian Arab from Jerusalem. His family was raised in the Lutheran tradition there. Lutherans in Jerusalem. Pretty much all that's different religion, sects of Christianity and religions of the world have some representation in that holy land, on the shores of the Mediterranean Sea. Easternmost Mediterranean Sea, and What was I going to say? He married an American woman that he met here in the Bay Area, and they raised four kids. I was number two. And we grew up in the Lutheran Church. Now, I still consider that my ethics are well based in the Lutheran and Christian traditions. I have studied in Sunday school, of course, the works and the life of Martin Luther. Not the King Jr. one, but the original Martin Luther of toward the end of the Middle Ages there, I guess. And in spite of that, that grounding in the Christian faith, I have fallen away. I no longer go to church. Sunday is indeed sleep-in day. Is in my retired life, pretty much every day is at the moment anyway. And never being able to completely extricate myself from the fundamentals that were the foundation of this body in this lifetime, I still do not worship God as such. In fact, I'm known for cursing up and down, even for apparently no reason, a lot of the time. I feel anger much of the time, which seems to contradict reassurances of peace and a closeness with God being made available to me. But I don't, I'm telling you this because I don't want people to think that I am coming from a personal position of religiosity in reading this book to you. I'm reading it because it was referred to me as an excellent book. Earlier this year, I attended a talk by the author Mark Braverman here in Santa Cruz. Obviously, that's where I bought the book, at the talk. And something made me decide to read it to you. I think the most important difference, the single most important difference thematically between this and my other readings on this radio program is the depth to which the author gets into religion, gets into the whole activity of belief in grace and oneness with God. I did not realize that the book would lean on that, at least in its early chapters, so heavily. But I see no reason to. It's an excellent book in terms of learning really heavy stuff about belief and religion. I see no reason to stop reading it. I'm going to continue through to the end. I just happened to notice that the end, I'm probably going to have to very carefully, once I'm finished with the last regular chapter, there are a couple of appendices here. Resources for information, connection, and further study. Jewish, Christian, and ecumenical organizations and programs. I want to give some touch base with you on who at least some of those organizations are when I'm done with the main text of the book. Appendix 2 is Christian Vigilance Against Anti-Semitism, the Case of the Presbyterian Church. Gets specifically into that, donates many pages. And then there's sermons, various sermons by the author and by other clergy that Braverman is close to. And sermons, lots of stuff, lots of interesting. Lots of research and thought has gone into Fatal Embrace. I also want to mention that it's interesting that he subtitles, in his subtitle, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, although the author is himself a Jew, he gives Christians top billing here. Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. I think that must be because he wants to direct this book to the many, many Christians who still have gone so drastically on the attempted balance of, on the pendulum of things towards atonement from the anti-Semitism pre-World War II. He wants to address that to them. And it's clearly still the author's opinions, you know, when you read a book like this, when someone gets so heavily into this and that and how this relates to stuff and all these big words, there's a tendency to take the words of the author, him or herself, as the very words of God. At least that's the case with me. It's difficult to maintain, but I believe strongly that one must never take as gospel, quote unquote, the words of the latest author they've heard from. I think people do that far too much. They read a book and they say, oh, this guy, this gal, they know everything that really needs to be known on the subject. They're the last word. Or they read an article or they've kind of fallen in love with the wisdom of this person or that person's opinions. And that's what they are. No matter how much based in fact, or for that matter in scripture, one's ideas are, that they still amount pretty much to opinions the way they're put together. Okay, no more of my pontificating. We're going to continue with chapter 6, hopefully close out chapter 6 next Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific. Don't forget my 3 p.m. Monday show in a couple of days. This is the Mideast Migraines program. 2 episodes per week, 2 hours each, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our schedule is available at freakradio.org. Send me your email. Doesn't have to be anything heavy. Just let me know that you're listening to the show, and up or down from that point on. MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. No phone calls today, but at least that's no troublesome, totally unrelevant calls coming in. Till next time, do what you can, but behave yourself.